Welcome, Legionaries, to episode 43 of Legion Cast. I am your host, Warwick, and joining me today is my co-host, Brandon.
From iron cometh strength. Welcome to Legion Cast.
Yeah, we got a really good book to talk about today, and I suspect that some of you were not expecting that from me, considering the author. That being said, a couple issues with this book, but overall, very good book. Definitely a breath of fresh air, considering a lot of what we've been dealing with the past couple of book episodes, or at least a few anyway. But before we get into all that, we've got some hobby news and some hobby updates. Brandon, what have you been working on?
Reading this book and listening to Perdurabo run around with the Iron Circle automata, I was like, man, I really want some robots. But I don't want some robots for my Iron Warriors right now because, well, to be quite frank, from GW, they're very expensive. So I was like, what can I make that doesn't have, that isn't going to be so expensive? And then I was like, I know, I'm going to make some Dark Angels Excendio Battle Automata. So I bought some stuff to convert up some of those and potentially run a Brethren of Iron Dark Angels list, which I think could be a lot of fun.
That sounds awesome. I myself have started painting a couple of Night Lords. I'm doing a test paint on one of my Leviathan Dreadnoughts that I kind of butchered last night when you and I were hanging out in Discord, but it's an easy fix. I kind of got carried away with some sloppy edge highlighting, and it doesn't look the way I want it to, so it's going to get redone. I've actually, aside from tabletop hobby, I've been losing a ton of time to video games because I decided to do a second playthrough of God of War Ragnarok, which ate up like all of last week and all of this weekend, so I'm still reeling from that. I think I've got one boss fight left in that, and then like a couple loose ends to wrap up in the end game, and then I'm done. Except the last boss fight is a freaking Valkyrie fight, and I am not prepared for that again.
Dude, I know how you feel. I've been playing a lot of Baldur's Gate 3 again. I caught that bug again, and then I just saw Horizon Forbidden West is coming to PC now, or I think it might be already out. And I was like,
oh. It's on Steam. It showed up on my recommended before we started recording. So I was like, ooh, that's going on the wish list for when it's on sale.
Yeah, that's probably going to happen. And then I was planning on getting Dragon's Dogma 2, but I've been hearing some concerning things, so I might hold off on that one.
So I'm hearing that, and this is probably a subject for a different podcast altogether, but I'm hearing that the gameplay and the game itself is very sound. Just ignore all the microtransactions and you're fine. But it's still scummy for them to do it that way, in my opinion.
Yeah, I heard it launched with some bugs on PC, so I'm kind of waiting for that to get ironed out.
Yeah, it's usually what I do these days. I don't pre-order shit. I think the last one that I think you and I both pre-ordered Hogwarts Legacy and Elden Ring, didn't we? And that was like the last couple of games that we pre-ordered.
Yeah, I think so. And then I will be pre-ordering Shadow of the Erdtree on that note.
Oh yeah, that's probably worth it.
Yeah. And then, but here, let's loop this back to a hobby conversation. Do you ever pre-order from GW?
Usually only books. Models, I just wait. Like if it's a book I really want, like the Beta Garmin book that's coming out, that's getting pre-ordered. The Siege of Chthonia book, I pre-ordered that. And there's another book that I pre-ordered for Heresy as well.
Yeah, I try to pre-order through my local game store, not through GW directly, because I want to support them in that way. But it seems like they get yanked around on their stock so often. Like, I pre-ordered the Exemplary Battles book, and they never ended up getting it. Like, they just never got it. Thankfully, when I pre-order at my local store, they don't require any cash up front. But it's really unfortunate that they got screwed that way in terms of stock. I just got it like this past weekend because I was like, I probably better get that.
Yeah, and that's why I'm kind of hot and cold on my local stores sometimes, because while they're run by very nice and very friendly people, my game group has been bounced around to a couple different stores now, I want to say. And like the guy at the local GW shop is awesome. I love dealing with him, but he's also on the other end of the metro. So it's really hard for me to get over there. getting to like the LFGs is a little easier, but then it's kind of wishy-washy on whether or not you can order stuff. Generally, I have good luck, but it's just as easy for me to just order through GW. And it's not like I don't spend money at my LFGs anyway. I spend a ton of money there usually. So, I mean, if I pre-order, it's usually through the website, but that doesn't stop me from spending money at the stores anyway, so.
Definitely. Yeah, it's, I don't know, the pre-order thing, it's a weird way to do it, but I suppose that's how they're going to do it. They need to get their freaking stock, their logistics figured out, because it's atrocious. But
I just think that that's going to be another GW trope for the rest of our lives. They're never going to get their, you know, their stocking figured out, or, you know, ordering whatever. It's like, I actually had to have you run down to the Citadel down there in Dallas and pick up a Night Lord's Tartarus Praetor and the Siegebreaker for me, because when I tried to order them online, they were out of the Tartarus Praetor. And when I tried to order the Siegebreaker, it was in stock. But when I went to the checkout, they said this item is currently out of stock. So I kind of got the runaround there. That it, and their website is still garbage. If anybody is still dealing with that shit, I mean, I feel for it. It is a terrible website, and they definitely overspent on it.
Yeah, there's no way to sugarcoat that. It's bad. Anyway, should we stop ranting about that? Because we got lots of news to talk about.
Yeah, so White Scar's players rejoice. You got a new model. You got the man Hibu Khan. He's the guy that chopped off Axeman's face. And he's got some back and forth history. He was, well, originally a loyal Imperial Space Marine, and then when the Heresy kicked off, he was going to side with Horus. And then the Khan put his boot down and said, no, you are going to go on an atonement quest now for the rest of the Heresy. And so he was off gallivanting around space as a kind of disgraced White Scar with the rest of his company to try and regain their honor. So kind of some cool White Scars back lore. Some cool Night Scars lore. I'm looking into getting into those books because they're pretty good. They're some of my favorite, actually. So I'm looking forward to that. But that's a little ways down the line. Anyway, Brandon, what do you think of this fella?
I think it's cool. This is, I believe, our second White Scars character.
Well, the Storm Seer is a console upgrade. He's just like the White Scars librarian. Because they can't take a librarian, they have to take a Storm Seer.
Yeah.
This is an actual named character.
Yeah, I'm just kind of... And this one isn't even that big of an offender. But I just really... It feels like the same legions are always getting models. And so I'm running out of steam on that. The Black Shields guy was kind of a breath of fresh air. But that one, honestly, is so niche. Like, who... How many people are realistically playing Black Shields?
Well, he'll work for... you're talking about not the Iron Hand, the...
No, I'm talking about the World Eater guy who's a Black Shield now.
Yeah, that is kind of niche. I wonder what that's going to look like when the book comes out. What running Black Shields is going to be like. But, it, you know, it could be cool. But like you said, it could be niche. It's Enrid Har.
Yeah.
Cool model, but we'll see. I like the White Scars. I'm happy they're getting another character model. I've always thought they're cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you're right. You know, Raven Guard don't have character models. Iron Hands, besides Shadrach Medusa that they just got, they don't have... I don't even think they have a Praetor model, right?
No, I don't think so.
And I'm sure we've complained about that ad nauseum on this podcast, but
yeah,
but I mean, that's
what I'm talking about, though, is like, you got Iron Hands who are getting their first name character. Meanwhile, Emperor's Children have like four.
Right. No, totally understandable. Mm-hmm. It would definitely be more fair if some of these lesser legions or other legions were getting some love.
On Hibu Khan, though, and talking about legions that we want love for. How much would you love a Bion Hendrikos for Iron Hands?
That would be really cool. I like him. He was at the same fight where Axeman lost his face. But he would be another cool one. Some of the Iron Warriors, or not, some of the Iron Hands from this book we're going to get into, I think, Sabbak Wayland, he would be a cool model to get, or the other Iron Father, the crazy one, Freighter for Thematica.
Yeah.
He would be a cool model to get. So yeah, I would look forward to any of those, but I mean, we'll just have to wait and see. GW is going to GW no matter how much we complain. It's kind of, that goes both ways, because on one hand, they're never going to listen to us. On the other hand, they're not going to listen to people that might bully them into doing something. So, you know, they're kind of like Nintendo that way. You know, they're just going to be Nintendo.
Yeah. Yep. I'm curious then, out of who do you think out of the Iron Warriors in this book you would like to see as an actual model in the game?
Kroger is really easy to say just because he's a big beat stick. Or Forex. I kind of liked Forex in this book. The guy that's the siege smith of this Storm Bajosh, Toramino, and he can get a rite of war or something where he gets like a bunch of artillery and shit. That would be awesome.
That would be cool. Yeah, I definitely, Forex is my number one pick by far. All right, do we have, we do have a little bit more news to talk about. AdeptCon was this weekend. And there was a very brief teaser where essentially we saw the cog of the Mechanicum. And
yep.
That was the teaser.
It was a picture of Mars, and then it flashed the Mechanicum seal, and that was it. So the speculation is, now I kind of thought maybe we'll get Mechanicum Knights, like they'll get better rules, but I don't know about that. I would just hope for some plastic 30k Mechanicum kits. I know you can get conversion resin pieces for your Skitarii, but it would be awesome to get like some legit plastic Mechanicum pieces.
Yeah, actually, I think that the popular rumor right now is that it would be Mechanicum Knights, which to me actually would be kind of disappointing. In that, I would just like to see regular Mechanicum get some plastic stuff, because it's such a prohibitively expensive army to get into. And
yeah, all their tanks are like $100, between $100 and $300, something like that. It's crazy.
Well, and like, you know, I've been looking at these automata for doing my Brethren of Iron, and it's, you know, the Castellax automata, which is their like troop choice for robots. They're $80 a piece, and you run them in maniples of three. Like, it's wild.
Yeah, it's really, really silly the way that their pricing works because I was always under the impression that they produce a lot of this stuff in resin because it was cheaper for them to produce, but it always ends up being more expensive than the plastic versions when they come out, or, you know, like a plastic equivalent, basically, for like a troop choice. Because for $80, you get 20 Space Marines. For $70, you get three robots. That is insane.
Yeah, that's the small robots, too. The ones that you need, like, 50 of.
Definitely not making the army, you know, accessible to your average guy.
Yeah, and you know what? Maybe that's the point. I don't really know. But I would just... While Mechanicum Knights would be awesome... I don't think that anybody could say that wouldn't be great. I would just like to see the regular Mechanicum get a little more love.
I'm not super impressed with Knights, though. The little that I've seen of them, I mean, they're cool. They look awesome. Mm-hmm. But on the tabletop, I've not been impressed.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird because it's one of those things where like you can either deal with a Knight or you can't.
I know the one game that I played against one, I got very lucky. I one-shotted it with a Cyclonic Meltalance. That was very lucky of me, but it just seemed like being able to do that in one turn was really, really rough for my opponent. Well, I don't want to say it was really rough for the opponent, but it just didn't seem like it should have happened. I mean, he still won, but yeah, I don't know. They're not, they kind of have the tank problem, you know. The tanks can either put in a lot of work and get one-shotted immediately, or put in no work and get one-shotted immediately.
Yeah, the super heavies are kind of weird. It's like, I ran my Typhon against Paul, and he was actually able to infiltrate his seekers, shove a meltabomb on it, and destroy it in one turn, and I didn't do anything with it, so that kind of soured me on the Typhon, because it's a super heavy, but it's not a super heavy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and my Cerberus has been kind of a 50-50 for me any game that I've taken it. Like, I ran it against you one game, and it didn't do anything the entire game, because I could never get line of sight on anything. The other game that I played on it, I was popping tanks left and right, because I actually had targets.
Yeah, yeah, it's a weird one, but I do remember in that game, I also just didn't have an answer for it either. So it kind of hung out by itself, doing nothing, but also I couldn't do anything about it. So, I don't know. Well, they're still cool.
What, do you, if it's not Mechanicum Knights, what is your hopes for this army besides cheaper automaton?
You want to go like full out there, just like dark Mechanicum. That would be so sick.
Yeah, I would love to see that.
Mm-hmm. They already have a couple. I've seen on the website, they have like a couple, like there's a Magos who's like a scorpion. And I'm like, that looks super cool. So I would just love some weird dark Mechanicum stuff.
Yeah, I think that could be really neat. Well, do we want to talk about anything else before we get in the next segment?
Let's talk about this book, because it's a great book. All right. Angel Exterminatus by Graham McNeil. One of Warwick's least favorite authors, producing one of the best books in this series. And this is why, this book specifically is why I argue with you guys all the time about this, is because when Graham McNeil writes Iron Warriors, it is fantastic.
My criticism of Graham McNeil has never been in regards to his writing of the Iron Warriors. It's been in regards to other habits of his. And while I have my issues with him, I will admit he is one of the better writers for this series.
Definitely. Well, I guess let's just start talking about this book. It is, like we said, it's an Iron Warriors book, which we up to this point haven't really gotten at all. The only story we've gotten is the Battle of Fal, which unfortunately influences this book a lot, which I say unfortunately because you can go back and listen to our episode on Shadows of Treachery, I believe is the book that's in. But
it's the Crimson Fist, and it does not do the Iron Warriors any favors.
It doesn't do the Iron Warriors any favors, and it's just not written well. So, and a lot of their decisions, a lot of what, particularly early on, a lot of things that influence what Perdurabo is doing and how he's acting is that. But he's definitely brought more. He's kind of toned back a bit. He doesn't smash up warsmiths for no reason anymore. We start on the planet of Hydra Cordatus, which for you 40K fans out there, a lot of this book is kind of meant to prequel Storm of Iron, which is Graham McNeil's 40K Iron Warriors book, which is an incredibly good book. Like that one, if you have not read it, go read it. It's got my favorite character in the entire setting, Warsmith Hansu, in it. And it is just fantastic. So Hydra Cordatus is actually the planet they are on in Storm of Iron. And they're here now because there's an Imperial Fist garrison here. And basically, without lacking orders from the Warmaster after Fal, the Iron Warriors have just been kind of running around being like, oh, there's Imperial Fists here. Why don't we just go stomp them? And that's what they're doing.
Yeah, so we start the book off at this kind of grandiose siege line of the Iron Warriors taking on the Imperial Fist garrison inside this kind of self-repairing fortress of kind of like, I can't tell if it's Archaeotech or Alien Tech. They don't actually know. So they've just found this living fortress or this self-repairing fortress on Hydra Cordatus, and the Imperial Fist set up shop there and are, they know they can't get out. They know nobody's coming to help them. So they're making their final stand. And it's taking quite a bit of elbow grease from the Iron Warriors to crack this fortress open. We get a scene of Forex and who's the other one? Well, Forex and one of the other warsmiths are on this rampart watching the siege. And they're just kind of, you know, they're doing as Protorabo ordered them. You know, they're just kind of going with the flow. But another warsmith gets the idea that he can accelerate this and break the siege early. So he orders an assault on another, on the opposite slope or a cornering slope. And they take the fight up into the wall, and only one legionary makes it up onto the wall. But it distracts the Imperial Fist just long enough for the rest of the Iron Warriors to go in, and the man himself, Perturabo, enters the battle and breaks the siege.
I believe that's Barbon Folk that that he is talking to, because they're talking about, oh, who's going to fill the next the last position in the Trident.
The Trident is their kind of upper echelon command, kind of like the Mournival that we've talked about earlier. So there are three warsmiths that are like, they're the big three. And, you know, they are the kind of counselors or, you know, first lieutenants to Perturabo. So Brandon, do you want to talk about kind of Perturabo's reaction to this warsmith ignoring orders and trying to march at the tune of his own drum?
Yeah, so this is Warsmith Harker, who is the Warsmith of the 23rd Grand Battalion, and he is also a Triarch. And it talks about, it talks about how he, unlike other Warsmiths, he is willing to spend lives a little more liberally than other Warsmiths are, where Forex or Barbon Falk or Toramino, any of those folks, would be a little... They view war the way Perturabo does. This is just a logistical affair that, you know, it's functionally a mathematical equation to them. Now, he is like, no, we need to pound out our men on the anvil battle. And so he launches this assault, which is very costly. And as you said, they do make it to the top of the wall, and then Perturabo comes and kind of carries the day with his iron circle. Perturabo reacts poorly to Harker's assault. So Harker is sitting there expecting to be lauded for his performance and for creating the opening for Perturabo to land on the walls and take the fortress. Instead, Perturabo rips him out of his cataphracty armor plate by plate and demotes him to being a regular legionary. And then he looks at Kroger, the only one to have made it up to the top of the wall, and just says, you're Warsmith now, and you're a Triarch. Which is a surprise to everyone.
Right, because Kroger was just a line legionary at the time, wasn't he? He wasn't...
He was a line legionary, and it's really well written in that, like, he's kind of just standing there as all the Triarchs form up and, like, all of this stuff, and he watches Perturabo grill these guys, and he's like, man, I really never want to be in their shoes. And less than 2 minutes later, they're like, you're a Triarch now.
Yeah, I thought that was really good. That was some good setup. I liked that.
Yeah, so anyway, Perturabo then asks Forex, okay, well, who should I elevate to the Triarch now that we're actually lacking two positions? Because Barossus, who is now in a dreadnought, was the one that he got all angry and angsty with at Foul. Again, I think that's just poor writing. This, what he does to Harker, is much more in line with the Perturabo that is really established throughout this series. So Forex, he recommends, I think you should take Barbon Falk, and I think you should take Toramino, who is the warsmith of the Storbizash, which is essentially the Iron Warriors Artillery Corps, which, if you know anything about Iron Warriors, is a pretty big position to be in. And Perturabo says, I agree with you about Falk, but I want Toramino to stay where he is. I'm going to pick this guy, Kroger. He's going to be the Warsmith now. And he's also going to be a Triarch because I want a straight shooter on my Triarch, among my Triarchs. And so that's what happens. And there's kind of this good scene of Forex and Falk and Kroger walking down the fortress together to go back to Perdurabo's bunker. And they're talking together. And Forex and Falk are talking like regular warsmiths. And they also, they kind of see Horus as like kind of removed. But Kroger says, it's our rebellion too. You need to take it like it is. You need to start acting like it's your rebellion as well, which I think is actually really interesting because as we see throughout the book with Perdurabo, this very much is his rebellion. Like he believes in Horus. Like he's like the emperor sucked, but let's give Horus a shot to do a better job.
Yeah. And I know we've talked quite a bit about the emperor being a bad dad, but like if at any point in the Great Crusade, the emperor had stopped Perdurabo and be like, hey, you're doing a really good job out here cracking open, you know, fortresses and, you know, leveling cities. I think you're great at that. I need you to kind of cool your jets a minute and go build some cities for me because I know you're really good at that too. And like give Perdurabo a little pat on the back and then like, you know, you got other talents and I really appreciate those. Just telling Perdurabo that he was appreciated at one point probably would have changed his attitude altogether. And it's like, that's all I think it would have taken. But, you know, we get this, you know, the emperor was a bad dad and I'm not going to be his son anymore. So I'm going to go do a rebellion. That's kind of the tragedy.
Well, and there's actually I can't remember what book it is, but one of them a while back where Rogel Dorn is having a conversation with Malkador on Terra. And he's like, you know, if we hadn't treated Perdurabo like absolute dog shit, he probably would have stayed loyal. And yeah, you know, Malkador exactly. At that point is just kind of like, oh, well, you know, it is what it is. But it is one of those things like, and we get to see Perdurabo. I don't know about you, but to me, Perdurabo is probably one of the best characterized Primarchs in this entire series.
Like, yeah,
we really get to see what makes him tick. And like, he's viewed as the siege master and like he can destroy things, but he really does dream so much bigger. He's like Gilliman in a way of he's thinking about what he wants to do in a post Great Crusade world.
Right.
But he's never been given the opportunity the way Gilliman has.
I think one of the best parts about this book that helps characterize him in that way is that he's got this foil throughout the whole story, Fulgrim, who is, you know, constantly looking at him like this trench digger who is just, you know, screwing around in the mud and the dirt and, you know, him and his grubby soldiers, they just go do the sieges, you know, that's all they're good for. But in reality, we see the side of Perdurabo, especially when you get into his inner sanctum, of he's this incredibly creative person. You know, he really appreciates history. He understands the lessons of the past. And it's just, it really does a good job of offsetting him or painting them with that perspective, that kind of negative perspective of this is all they're good for, and then balancing it against the side of Perdurabo that we actually get to see. So it's definitely a good kind of balance that they strike here between Fulgrim telling us what the Iron Warriors are and then Perdurabo showing us what the Iron Warriors are.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that kind of moves us along to essentially we get to see inside of Perdurabo's bunker, and his personal bunker has a gigantic labyrinth in it that his command sanctum is at the center of, and only he knows the way through. And even Forex is like, I've been here a ton of times, and let me tell you, I can never find my way through this thing. And, you know, Forex is also an incredible, like, you know, he's got eidetic memory, just like all Astartes do, but none of them can figure out, they all get completely turned around in this place. And it talks about how Perdurabo found these writings of this inventor from the Firenze, people, which I think this is kind of meant to be a reference to Michelangelo. Because Firenze is Italian for Florence. So,
see, I was kind of wondering.
That's what it is.
I was kind of wondering about that. I wasn't really sure where that fit in, but that would be kind of interesting if that's the case.
Well, at first I thought it was Da Vinci, because Da Vinci's more of an inventor type than Michelangelo. But I don't remember if Da Vinci's even from... I know Michelangelo's from Florence.
I'm not sure on Da Vinci.
Yeah.
No, but that's a cool thing to point out if that's the case. What do they call it? The Fira, Castafira, no. Well, anyway, this inner sanctum, when they get through this maze, is really incredible. And Perturabo just has this kind of modular fortress and maze set up that they could just pick up and put down, so they store it on the ship, and when they need to land a command post, they just drop this thing down and set it up there on the spot. And when they get inside, it's full of all these ancient diagrams, texts. He's got this big library of all these, you know, old texts that he and Magnus actually pieced together. And all, of course, like all of Perturabo's like personal blueprints, the kind of things that he's been working on. He's got shelves of kind of miniature automaton. It even describes like a miniature warhound that is almost identical to like a full-sized warhound Titan. And which is a good Chekhov's gun, by the way, because they bring it up a couple of times.
For more than one reason, it's a good Chekhov's gun.
Yeah.
Even for reasons outside of this book.
Oh, you'll have to explain that to me.
Okay, so if you remember, there's a point where Forex is talking about how the Oracle and Locos told him that an iron behemoth would herald his doom.
Okay.
He gets killed by a warhound in Storm of Iron.
Oh, shit. I didn't know that.
Well, so, and that is after he power fists another warhound. So he kills a warhound, and then its maniple partner comes around, and he's like, oh, fuck, let's go. And it just Vulcan mega bolters him.
That's awesome. Okay, I didn't know that. I haven't read Storm of Iron. I have it on, it's on audiobook now. I don't know if you knew that, but
I didn't know that. I might pick it up.
That is on my list. Oh, so it also explains another scene later on where Forex is talking about how he's never liked that model and he couldn't tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
So,
like I said, there is a ton of foreshadowing in this book for Storm of Iron.
Okay, that's awesome. Yeah, I definitely need to read that one now. Right, so the inner sanctum here is a marvel to behold, and Perturabo's got a ton of stuff in here, and you know, it's definitely the kind of hangout of a Primarch that likes to build stuff. And so far, we have not seen that side of Perturabo. Like, we knew he probably had, like, some engineering know-how just for being, like, a master siege master or, the kind of craft that goes alongside with that. But he's also got a lot of, like, miniature diagrams and, you know, he likes architecture and all sorts of just different intricate stuff. And it really kind of shines a light on how creative the guy is. And we've not seen that because all we've ever heard about the Iron Warriors is that they just break open fortresses. That's all they ever do. But we've seen a much more introspective version of these characters already, or of their character in general already. And, you know, there's some exchange here about what's going to happen. And Perturabo is talking about how they're meeting with the Emperor's children and, you know, they're going to, you know, go on a mission with them. And who was it? Was it Kroger that said something like, oh, so we're taking orders from Fulgrim now, you know, just because the War Master's not talking to us or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Perturabo is like, how does Perturabo handle this? He's like, you know, we're not taking orders from the Emperor's children. We're going to work with them because, you know, we've got the opportunity to, basically, right?
Well, and he still thinks Fulgrim's orders are to attack Mars. So he thinks, okay, well, they want our help to break open the forges in Mars. And he's even he's walking them through, here's my plans to take these forge complexes. So, like, he's already started planning out for this activity. obviously when the Emperor's children arrive, that is not what they have in mind. And Warwick, why don't you talk about this this arrival of Fulgrim, which is an absolute, well, it's a thing.
Yeah, so when the Emperor's children land, they make planetfall in this just grotesque carnivalia of mutant freaks and aberrations. It's full of painted whores, and they're all covered in this just pungent, noxious, like, perfume and cologne. And it's just this sensory kind of nightmare for the Iron Warriors, because they're still living in reality. You know, the warp hasn't quite broken open yet for them, so to speak. The Emperor's children, on the other hand, post-Meravigila, have just devolved into these jittering weirdos and freaks. And, it's just this monstrous cavalcade of one freak show after another. And the Iron Warriors are rightly kind of horrified by this, because the Emperor's children were just the model of soldiery up until this point. And Fulgrim makes planetfall nearly immediately with this cavalcade. And the it's Perturabo and the Trident are still in the Inner Sanctum when Fulgrim lands, because Perturabo said, Fulgrim is going to be a couple hours planning his, this decadent arrival of his. So, we've got time to kind of put together our own plan down here. Well, now Perturabo gets word that Fulgrim has reached the planet. He's now got to bust a gut to get out there and greet his brother, which totally catches him off guard, because that's not like Fulgrim at all. He's very much the pomp and circumstance kind of guy. He's not just going to land on the planet right away. Well, something clearly about Fulgrim has changed, and this kind of nightmare processional that we see from the Emperor's children really showcases that.
Yeah, so Fulgrim does greet Perturabo, and he gives him a gift, and this gift is a cloak of swirling black and gold with a crest, with his legion crest as a clasp, but set in it is this stone. And Perturabo really likes this thing. Like, he immediately puts it on. You can tell, like, it doesn't really say in the book, but you can tell he really enjoys just getting a gift from his brother. And then he gives his brother a gift as well, which is two captive Imperial fists, which I was like, this is kind of an odd gift, but maybe Fulgrim had asked for it, and that just doesn't happen on the page. That's what they give him, and they hand him over, and they're like wrapped in barbed wire and all jacked up, and
they were chained to Barossus.
Yeah, so it's a pretty grotesque scene of that handoff. But Fulgrim says he wants to have this conversation, and so they go back to Perturabo's sanctum, and he's looking around, kind of checking out. And he's like, I had no idea you were so creative with all of this stuff. And he's like, whatever. And he's looking through like his architectural drawings. He's like, have you ever built any of these? And he says, well, I built one. And he says, I forgot you built the Colosseum on Nicaea. And he's like, yeah, and I hate it because it was misused by the Emperor. So you see this part of Perturabo, he builds these magnificent structures, but he's almost like out of touch with this this idea that, once you build this thing, once you build this structure, it's really not yours anymore. And so he doesn't like the idea of people misusing what he uses or what he builds in his own mind. But Fulgrim says, I want to tell you this story. And he has this Eldar with him, and has to convince Perturabo and his triarchs not to kill the Eldar, which it isn't really super well explained how Fulgrim came across this Eldar.
Part of my problem with the story is the lack of setup for some of the things that we have in it.
Mm-hmm.
The Eldar are not set up.
For the why other Eldar is even worse set up.
Agreed. Well, that's what I'm saying. Both the Eldar are set up really poorly. The Morgadr Stone, we have no idea where it comes from, how Fulgrim got it, what he's doing with it. Well, we know what he's doing with it. We find out anyway. And I just feel like the Eldar could have been a part of this, like a deeper part of this story, and the Morgadr Stone could have been a deeper part of this story if we hadn't gotten, you know, six dog shit filler stories in the anthology books we've been covering between this book and, you know, before this book, basically. So a lot of the filler was definitely wasted because it could have been the setup for something awesome right here, and they just dropped the ball on it. Anyway, back to the Eldar.
Yeah, so he's just got this Eldar in tow. But he says, here, build me this theater, and I'll tell you this story. And Perdurabo's like, why do you need me to build an entire theater just to tell a story?
I want to sing!
Yeah. But I think this plays well that Perdurabo agrees to this because he's like, okay, this is more the Fulgrim I was thinking I would encounter. Of course he wants me to build an entire amphitheater just so that he can have a conversation with me. That's much more what I was expecting. So he builds it, and it's called the Phaleochron, and it's like this triumph of architecture.
And there's a pretty cool scene right here of all the Iron Warriors working together in tandem at the command of Perdurabo to hone every single detail to perfection to build this giant theater. It's a really cool scene. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, like even Kroger, who has been set up to be kind of this like bloodthirsty dude, he's on it.
The Iron Warriors like to build stuff, and it's cool to watch them build stuff. They just never got the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So they build this thing, and like Fulgrim is so impressed. And then he begins to tell this story about the Eldar gods and how they had this battle and how a couple of them got it on. And then their baby was like a demon baby. And what we know as the readers is this is a heavily bastardized birth of Slaanesh story.
Yeah, and it kind of like covers the fall of the Eldar, the birth of Slaanesh, and the war in heaven and all that shit. And basically the gist of the story is that now there's this cache of ancient Eldar weapons that could be, you know, like the defining characteristic of Horus's war, and we need to go get them for the War Master, because then he'll really appreciate us. And that's kind of Fulgrim's premise of, you know, of trying to convince Perdurabo and the Iron Warriors to accompany them to this lost Eldar stronghold that is the resting place of the Angel Exterminatus.
Yeah, and so he's telling this story, and Perdurabo, it's really fun because Fulgrim is like trying to be very dramatic and have a flair for it, and Perdurabo's sitting there the whole time like, get to the point. Get to the point. Okay, get to the point. And
meanwhile,
which essentially is, hey, there's a bunch of Eldar like planet shaking weapons. We need to go get them.
Meanwhile, while this is all going on, we have a little cutaway to some new characters. We have Sabic Wayland of the Iron Hands and Nykona Shuriken from the Raven Guard. They are members of the Shattered Legion, survivors of Istvan, and they're here to do a little assassination. Well, originally they were there to observe and see what's going on, and then Shuriken gets a bead on Fulgrim's dome with his kick-ass needle rifle and says, I'm going to go ahead and shoot that Primarch in the head. And he does. And Fulgrim gets shot in the head, and that's the end of the story.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah,
really enjoyed watching
blasted right in the dome,
shot in the face.
Yeah, no. So Fulgrim drops like a bag of shit mid play, and of course, Perdurabo and the Iron Circle freak out and form a cordon around him. But Fulgrim's alive; it didn't kill him. It just, you know, rung the bell a little bit, so to speak.
Which
and,
is
the
big sad.
Yeah, it's the base set. We all wanted him to get what he had coming to him. No, but Fabius shows up and pulls a slug out of his brain, well, out of his skull. and Fulgrim lives. And meanwhile, Wayland and Shuriken are running like demons to try and get out of there because now the entire war footing is on the lookout for them. They're able to extract with the help of a custom-built Storm Eagle that Wayland tuned up. Excuse me, sorry. Wayland is an Iron Father, so he's kind of a tech priest or a tech marine. He was trained on Mars, and then he was returned to the Legion to fulfill like their tech marine kind of role. But the Iron Fathers have a much deeper connection to that kind of thing, so they're kind of engineers and fabricators in their own right. So he was able to soup up this kick-ass Storm Eagle, and they zoom out of there, and they get back to their ship, the Sisypheum, which is crewed by mostly Iron Hands. It is a survivor of the drop site massacre. It's got a couple of salamanders and a single Raven Guard on board with them.
Okay. And I have a problem with the Sisypheum.
Okay.
This needs to be a Raven Guard ship.
Because you don't think an Iron Hand ship would have made it out of there?
Because I don't think an Iron Hand ship is designed to be as stealthy as this thing is repetitively.
Okay, I can see that. That makes sense. The thing about the Sisypheum is that it has been patched and repaired beyond all recognition. It no longer registers as the ship that it may once have been. And they barely got out of Istvan by the skin of their teeth. Every Iron Hand on board has been working nonstop to keep it repaired. And they have been doing hit and run operations against traitor forces ever since the drop site massacre. And they somehow caught wind of these events going on and are now going to try and run interference for this campaign of whatever the Emperor's Children are going to do. And leading this operation is Captain Ulrak Brantham, who was mortally wounded at the drop site massacre, but is put on life support with some kind of archaeotech that may be killing him. So he's also kept in stasis between missions, and they only wake him up to inload data to his neural network and receive orders and feedback.
It's interesting. It kind of feels like it doesn't really have the room to breathe. Everything else up to this point is kind of methodically set up. And then they're like, and there's this Iron Hands ship, and it's got this captain who has this thing clamped to him, and he's in stasis, and also this thing's super stealthy, and also they just have these retrofitted Storm Eagles, and it's just throwing a lot at you. And to me, it was like, why are these guys here? This is a story about Perdurabo and Fulgrim.
Well, I'm on the fence about it too. I do think the story benefits from having a foil, and I think the Iron Hands could do a much better job of that if they had more setup. They just don't get it. So for all of their efforts throughout this story, I'm not sure they ever make a difference.
It just kind of feels, and you know, you can feel free to argue with me if you think I'm wrong here, but it just kind of feels like they decided that they need a loyalist element in this story. Like Black Library decided, we're telling us it's got to have some kind of loyalists in it, which I just don't think they need it.
I don't think they do that. I don't think that they hand down edicts like that to their writers. I think that at some point, somebody decided to take a liberty with this element of the story. That being said, it's too much. It doesn't really fit in. It's not as good as it.
Yeah. And here's my question to you.
It's not as good as it could be.
Yeah.
But all that considered, this is a better Iron Hand story than we've had thus far, save the little bit we get in Fulgrim.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm not going to fight with you there, but let me ask you this. Where do they actually push the story forward?
Like, they don't. And that's what I'm saying. For all their efforts in the story, they don't really accomplish anything. Because by the end of the book, the Iron Warriors, Emperor's Children, and the Iron Hands are all in the same place.
Yeah.
That they started at, basically. Well, except Fulgrim, of course, but we'll get there when we get there.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, they decide, okay, we're going to chase after these guys. We're going to go after these weapons as well to try and destroy them or something like that. And then is it this point that they also have an Eldar?
Right. So the Emperor's children show up with Karuchi Vora, and the Iron Hands show up with Varuchi Vora. So we as the readers know these assholes are connected. And why are these loyalists working with an Eldar? And why are the traitors working with an Eldar?
Well, and it's even more jarring, though, because, like, Fulgrim, you're like, okay, this had no setup, but, like, he wanted to go here. He came to this place. So, yeah, we just, you know, we kind of have this dude as a MacGuffin of how they're going to get into the Eye of Terror. The Shattered Legions guys, they just find out what's going on, and they're like, well, it's a good thing that we just happen to have this Eldar kicking around in the trunk. Like, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Not only do they have this Eldar with them, he is also the perfect guide to get them through this very obscure lane of the Eye of Terror.
Yeah.
It's so, just like, it's super convenient setup for everybody.
Yeah, it's pretty horrendous. Anyway, so they're able to actually like make good time and get it. They're ahead of the traitors. Which actually, let's talk about the word traitor for a second, because there's a part on Hydra Cordatus where they're having this conversation among Perturabo and his warsmiths, and he says, "You will not refer to the enemy as loyalists." And they say, "Well, why not?" And he says, "Because if they're loyalists, what does that make us?" What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's an interesting question that, you know, it kind of comes back to the root of the heresy is like, why did Horus rebel? Well, he saw that the Emperor was being just as much of a despot and an oppressor as anyone else that they have been conquering throughout the Great Crusade. So I think Perturabo definitely has the same kind of worldview on the whole thing where you know, the Emperor is just another tyrant. And, you know, maybe if we put our faith into somebody else, they will finally deliver us from this cycle of servitude and, you know, mindless following and all that kind of utopian shit or whatever that they're trying to build towards. And it's certainly very interesting. And I appreciate Perturabo for having that perspective because it makes the heresy that much more complex. Perturabo's not just rebelling because the Emperor was mean to him. He's rebelling because he saw that the Emperor was no better than any of the other tyrants in the galaxy.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting, and we haven't gotten to this yet, but it's an interesting foil between him and with the Khan. Because the Khan kind of has the same revelation, but just then has the opposite decision of, yeah, he is a tyrant and no better than any other tyrant, but you know what? He's our tyrant. So we're going to stick with that.
And also the tyrant that basically united humanity. So yeah, there's got to be some merit in that, right?
They journey to the Eye of Terror, and we find out Perturabo has actually, anywhere he goes, he is always able to see the Eye of Terror. And that's what part of what makes him so paranoid. And we actually find out that he had talked to Ferris Manus about this. And it's the only one person he talked to about it. And Ferris kind of shut him down and didn't want to talk about it. So he never did. But he's sitting there staring at this thing. And that's kind of a part of the reason why he decided to go on this trip. Because he even tells his warsmiths, he's like, yeah, Fulgrim is definitely hiding stuff from us. And like, we don't know everything of what he actually wants to do. But he's kind of intrigued by, you know, I've seen this thing my entire life. I'm going to go into it. And he actually is the one who names it the Eye of Terror. He re-enters it in the astrogation charts as the Eye of Terror. And it will forever be so.
Yeah, and it actually populates across imperial systems and traitor systems all at the same time well, eventually that information just kind of starts to populate throughout all the different computer systems, mm-hmm. and, you know, throughout different navies, way stations, stuff like that. And that's how it gets cemented in history. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought so too. Gosh, what's next here? Do we want to talk about like the,
Well, we need to get into what happens when they're going through the paths above and the paths below.
Well, should we talk about the warrior exchange before we talk about that? Oh,
yeah, go ahead and break that down real quick.
Okay, yeah, this part is pretty wild. So, one thing, we haven't talked about this. Eidolon's back, even though he got his head chopped off. So that's a thing.
Yeah, but Phebeus Bill is like, death is just a switch and I can turn it off and on, whatever.
Blah, blah, blah. We're going to need to rant about that in a bit.
Yeah.
Because this happens more than once and I don't like it. Anyway. So Eidolon's back and they decided to do this warrior exchange. Now, Lucius has been here around here the whole time and he's just been kind of talking shit to the Triarchs and they're like, yeah, you know what? We want to absolutely beat the snot out of you. And he, of course, is being Lucius. Is like, I'd love to see you try and all of that crap. But he ends up hanging out with the equivalent of the Iron Warrior's Lodge, which is called the Dodecatheon. And in the Dodecatheon, what they do is they sit there and they play war games against each other. They literally sit and play Warhammer all day. But what they do is they re-fight old battles and then they fight potential new ones in simulators. And we get this great scene where Lucius is just sitting there watching because they're doing this battle brother exchange to build camaraderie among the legions. But what steals the scene is Perturabo and Kroger fight the siege of the Imperial Palace out against each other. First Kroger attacking and then Perturabo attacking. And whether on attack or defense, Perturabo is able to just absolutely wipe the floor with Kroger. And it really does put on display his absolute genius and how good he is at this thing. And it definitely gives you the impression of like, okay, if Perturabo gets to Terra, he's going to crack this sucker open. And you definitely get that confidence built in him. Anyway, if we jump over to what is going on the Pride of the Emperor, they've sent Sultan Volbron, who is known as the Stone Rot because he can quote unquote speak to the stone. He's just really good at earthworks and stuff like that. Along with this this legionary, Cassius Grendel. Grendel. Let's just call him Grendel. Who is actually a member of Warsmith Barossus' company and is helping train Barossus understand his new weaknesses as a dreadnought. Like, Grendel gets on top of him with a power fist and starts hammering on his roof. But anyway, they get sent over to the Pride of the Emperor, and like Eidolon is leading them through La Fenice, which they have just filled with debauchery and all kinds of stuff. But Grendel sees this one captain, I believe it's Chrysander of the Blades is his name, and he's like leaping around and showing off, and Eidolon's like, oh yeah, we have better.
He's a Lucius wannabe.
Essentially, yeah. Sultan Volbron keeps following Eidolon after Grendel kind of peels off to watch the swordsman do his thing. And they start drinking together. And he's like, oh, this wine's really good. What is it? And he's like, oh, it's distilled from the tears of slaves. And like, just kind of wild crap that's happening. And basically what they're doing is they're trying to convert Volbron to worship Slaanesh. And there comes a point where he's like into it and he's really getting into it. And they're like, drink this and you will have fully committed yourself to the Dark Prince. And then you can go back to your legion and spread his worship through your legion. And he's like, all right, let's do it. And he's going to drink this. And then Grendel bursts in. And he's like, what are you doing here? And Grendel's like, you forgot the iron within, and just decks him.
And he knocks him out cold.
Yeah. He wakes up on the Apothecarian of the Iron Blood, and he's like, I'm a warsmith, and that legionary punched me. And Perdurabo's like, dude, shut up. He saved your life. And basically, yeah, they're like, I don't know what's going on over there, but we're not doing this exchange anymore.
Yeah, absolutely wild. The part where they walk by the hookahs that are like, they have intestinal tubing as like the hoses. I was like, ugh,
yeah, gross.
But meanwhile,
that whole scene there though, like it just, the perfect climax. It's like, you forgot the iron within. Whack.
Well, while all that's going on, we get a little cutaway back to the Sisyphean, where we meet Freighter Thematica, who's another Iron Father, who is nuttier than squirrel shit. He is just
yeah,
bonkers.
But he's fun.
He's like mad scientist fun. He's probably my favorite character on the Sisyphean. He's just like, he's fucking bonkers, folks. Because he's trying to develop a, like, matter transference device. And basically what he wants to do is shoot a Primarch in the head with it, and it will teleport his head somewhere else and swap it with something else. So the scene is like, he's trying to swap this iron sphere and this copper sphere. He's trying to, like, teleport him into different places. And the generators that he has aren't powerful enough, so he's like, well, I need to get some, you know, some stronger generators. So the next logical step is to wire this experimental device into the ship's main reactor, right?
Which he was specifically told not to do, and he does it anyway.
And it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission, which is exactly what happens. So while the Iron Warriors and Emperor's Children fleet are taking the paths above through the Eye of Terror with their Eldar guide, the Sisyphean is taking the paths below with their Eldar guide. And during all this, Thematica overloads the ship's power core, causes a big disturbance out in space that everybody can see, and the ship loses power. Naturally, Perdurabo's like, oh, well, there's that Iron Hand ship. We're just going to shoot him out of the sky. No. Fulgrim has a better idea. He positions his ships between Perdurabo's and the Sisyphean so that the Emperor's Children can board. To which Perdurabo just goes, fuck. Ready, teleporters.
Yeah, this is he puts the Andronicus between the Iron Blood and the Sisyphean, and he's like, you won't shoot my own ship out of the sky. Sometimes foreshadowing is obvious. But yeah, so the Emperor's Children, they launch a bunch of boarding torpedoes, and we get to see what Fabulous Bill has been working on. It's freaks. The answer is
it's freaks. Always freaks. He calls them the Terror.
Yeah, there's something all right. Well, anyway, which, they're basically just mutant monsters.
They're his babies. And they're basically mutated legionaries from the Drop Site Massacre. Oh, and the Imperial Fist captives that got gifted to him at Hydra Cordatus.
Yeah, and we do get to see an interesting thing. Apparently the Imperial Fist gene seed is so stable that they're actually the only ones that are able to maintain any form of cognitive function. And basically what it is that this captain that we're following in this, Felix Cassander, he's basically just a passenger in his own body because he's so pumped full of chem stims and his metabolism is so messed up that he doesn't have any control over what he is doing.
We call that coked to the gills.
Yes. Yes, we do. And so he's like, he has this like whole moment, and it's actually really well written, where like he is like, I don't want to kill this Iron Hand. And he's like, please, you're my brother. And then he just, the pistol comes up and he just rips him to shreds. And he's like, I hate myself so much.
Yeah, so he's this big mutant freak trying not to kill Iron Hands, and so he picks one up and is just like yelling in his face, "I don't want to kill you! I don't want to kill you!"
But he doesn't have, like, his jowls are so deformed that all it comes out is like,
So he ends up killing a bunch of Iron Hands against his own will, because the stims and all the shit in his system makes him just, he can't control himself. He basically obeys Fabius's commands this entire time.
Yeah, which it's good. It's well written. And then the Iron Hands are kind of at the point where they're like, all right, well, Thematica, you've killed us all. So, you know, thanks for that. And he's like, wait. I have a plan.
He always has a plan. So instead of allowing the reactor to overload and destroy the ship, which it looks like that's what's going to happen. Meanwhile, the Iron Warriors and the Emperor's Children are seeing these readings, and they know what's coming. The ship is going to explode, and it's going to kill two Primarchs with it. Wait, no, is Fulgrim even there?
Fulgrim's not on the ship.
Okay, Fulgrim's not there, but Perturabo is. Yes. So the Iron Hands are like, we can kill a Primarch if we just overload the, you know, let the reactor melt down. And that's the end of Perturabo. And so it seems like that's the way it's going to go. But Thematica's like, nah, we're not going to do that. Go ahead and shift all of the control to the engines over to me. And he siphons all the power from the overloading generator through the engines and blasts them out through the Eye of Terror at a million miles a minute.
Yeah, and they ram the Andronicus. Yeah. The best part of this, too, is that Perturabo gets these readings, and Kroger looks at him and is like, Lord, you have to leave, and because they're going to overload the ship. And he's like, I'm not leaving. I'm Primarch. You can't tell me what to do. And all the Triarchs are eventually like, no, they're doing this because they want to say that they brought down a Primarch. So you need to leave. And he's like, you know what? Fucking all the Iron Warriors on this ship are leaving. And we're getting out of here. And they teleport back to the Iron Blood. And he's sitting there staring at the ship as they're like, oh, any minute now it'll blow up. And they're pulling away. And he's like, wait, stop. And they're like, we're going to be caught in the blast if we stop. Us and the Andronicus. And he's like, should we tell the Andronicus to stop? Is there something you see? He's like, nope. Fulgrim wanted to fuck me, and here's how I fuck him right back. And so this thing blasts off, and it passes the Iron Blood, and it even goes back to Thematica, and he's like, oh, I see the Iron Warrior's ship stopped. They must know what I'm up to. But why aren't they telling the Emperor's Children? So the Andronicus just gets wrecked by this absolute rocket sausage shooting off into space.
Yeah, split in half.
Yeah. And then they're like, well, you know, we'll rescue some of those guys, but they fucking deserved it.
The following scene with all of the Emperor's Children casualties on board the Iron Blood is pretty horrific, because none of the Emperor's Children apothecaries show up to, you know, administer any kind of first aid or to recover Gene Seed from dying Marines. They're just left there to die by the Emperor's Children. And without orders, the Iron Warriors apothecaries go to render aid. And then after a while, they just kind of give up, because they're like, they don't want our help. They keep refusing help. And the only one there is their chief apothecary, Honorable Sulaco, who I thought was kind of cool. A couple of scenes. We had a scene with him in the Dodecatheon. And this scene,
he's called
here,
Honorable, because he's the leader of the Dodecatheon.
And as rumor would have it, he is worthy of the title. And so I thought he was kind of cool, the little bit we get to see of him.
Oh, and, dude, this is like, I was like, there's so many points in this book where I'm like, fuck the Emperor's Children.
Yeah.
This one in particular.
Yeah. So he's going around administering aid, and he, you know, at the end of, very end of the scene, he's removing the Gene Seed and getting ready to, like, hand it over or whatever. And Fabius shows up and says, that's not yours. Sticks him with a needle of some knockout drug, kills Sulaco there on the spot. And that's the end of the scene.
Yeah. Well, he takes his Gene Seed. He takes the Iron Warrior's gene seed and his body, actually. Yeah,
the body shows up in his lab later on, lab on the other ship.
And it's also the origin story for how Lucius gets a whip.
And how Lucius gets a whip. And the end of this story, we get the Hansu name drop as well. So it's rumored that this gene seed is kind of the base template for him.
Yeah, I think Hansu's actually an Imperial Fist.
He's a hybrid because he is part of Honorable Sulaco's and Chrysander's gene seed.
Oh, I fucking hate this one.
Oh, yeah,
so
dude,
much.
This scene makes your blood boil because the Emperor's children obviously don't give a shit if these guys die, but suddenly Fabius gives a shit if the other apothecaries try to recover gene seed for them.
Yeah, he just sees it as an opportunity to steal more gene seed.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's such bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it definitely makes you think, like, well, I know that the Iron Warriors are the bad guys, but maybe they're kind of the good guys.
Yeah, they're not as bad as those bad guys.
I mean, if I was going to have to fight one of them, I know who I'd pick.
Yeah. Yeah, one of them's not gross and weird.
The one with the happy ending.
Look, man, I mean, there's a reason that my story for my Emperor's Children is they saw the Merovingia and they were like, yeah, no, we're not going to do this anymore. And then they just leave the rest of the Legion. Anyway, so they get to this planet, this Eldar planet, and Perturabo notices some things. First off, it's a perfect sphere. He's like, that doesn't just happen. Also, it's right next to a black hole, and that doesn't just happen.
Yeah, it's not having any gravitational effect on it.
Yeah.
And the Eldar just says some shit like, or maybe it's Fulgrim that says something like, oh, the goddess that made this world kept it close to her chest, and that's why nothing's happening to it.
Yeah, and the Eldar are just like, oh yeah, you know, up is down, and left is right. And they're just like, yeah, whatever, don't talk to me. Perturabo, I think at one point, literally looks at Karuchi Vola and is like, don't talk to me. I don't like you.
So Fulgrim wants to land immediately, but Perturabo is like, oh, you know what? We missed a scene.
What did we miss?
We missed the scene with the Warhound Titan.
Yes.
Okay, we need to go back a minute. Yes. After the debacle with trying to board the Sisyphean, Perturabo's like, the Emperor's children are fucking this up for us, and I need to have a talk with my brother. So he invites Fulgrim, you know, over to his inner sanctum aboard the ship again. And, you know, when Fulgrim shows up, Perturabo is working on his miniature Warhound Titan, kind of straightening some gears and fixing the timing on the perpetual motion engine, which Fulgrim's like, I thought that was impossible. And Perturabo's like, no, I reverse engineered it from, you know, these frenzy diagrams. And then Vulcan helped me build it. And which I thought was like some cool, like, you know, like a brotherly bonding moment. Like he and Vulcan got to work on something together. Now, not that it means anything now, but, you know, Perturabo enjoyed having a relationship. Like you said earlier, he liked getting stuff, but I think more important than that, he always wanted a relationship with his brothers. He just never really got it. And we kind of get the feeling that some of that might stem from what happened on his home planet of Olympia, because there was a rebellion on Olympia long ago, and Perturabo and the Iron Warriors flattened it in response. And so he always kind of felt like his brothers looked down on him for not being able to maintain control of his homeworld. So he kind of has this, you know, this desire for brotherly, you know, comradeship that, you know, when Fulgrim gives him the gift he gets, when he got to work on the Warhound with Vulcan, that was important to him. That's why he still has it. Well, Fulgrim is like just kind of being an asshole. He's like, I don't care. You know, we lost some bodies. Who gives a shit? I don't care if your mud grubbers die, whatever. And Perturabo's like, can you hear the, can you hear the ticking in this perpetual motion engine? It's losing time. Fulgrim's like, I don't give a shit about that. Perturabo's just like, just listen. And so Fulgrim puts his face right down next to this Warhound Titan to observe it. And Perturabo slams his head repeatedly into this miniature Warhound Titan, just sending it to pieces. Now, Fulgrim's got, like, Lucius, I think Eidolon is there.
And Julius Caseron.
Julius Caseron, to which the Trident immediately fall on them and subdue them.
Yeah, Kroger gets particular enjoyment out of subduing Lucius.
Right. So it's a really cool scene. Perdurabo puts Fulgrim in his place and basically says, you are surrendering command of this mission to me immediately. If not, the Iron Warriors are leaving this theater. And Fulgrim doesn't really have a choice. He has to agree to it if he wants to get down to this planet. And so after humiliating Fulgrim, he sends him away. And isn't Kroger like... Kroger says something like, isn't it a bad idea to shame him like that and just turn him loose? And Perdurabo says, well, those three aren't going to say anything, and Fulgrim's not going to talk about it. We're the only ones that know. If he wants to, you know, keep his reputation clean, he'll keep his mouth shut. And he basically does. So Perdurabo really has a good read on Fulgrim throughout the whole story. You know, through most of the story, he knows that Fulgrim's up to something the entire time. He just doesn't know what.
Yeah, and Forex does also mention, he's like, I don't know if this was a good idea to do in front of his warriors. So it's kind of foreshadowed that might be a thing, but I don't know that it really ends up being anything.
I don't think it does. Now, Fulgrim wants to land immediately, but Perdurabo's like, no, we're going to bomb this shit out of it first. And Fulgrim's like, no, you might damage what's below. And Perdurabo notices that immediately. He doesn't say the weapons or the weapon or the Angel Exterminatus, anything like that. He just says what's below. So again, Perdurabo is like, okay, something else is going on here. But he wants to see it through for whatever reason, so he goes along with it. Like I said, they bomb the crap out of this landing site. They absolutely flatten it. And then they land down there. And they've got like this cool mobile fortress building operation where it scoops up all the rubble from the blast site and starts forming it into like concrete bricks that they can lay down and make parapets and walls and shit. And it's a really cool scene. Again, like watching the Iron Warriors build stuff is fascinating to me. The way that this is written is so cool.
Well, I really enjoy the part too where Kroger, one of the things that's going on is they're having such trouble building their fortress. They're way behind schedule. And Kroger has actually found a confidant as being the new warsmith, someone that he can kind of talk to about being a warsmith. And that is Harker, his former warsmith.
Yeah.
And he is like, yeah, you are definitely going to betray me, but that's why I want to keep you around.
Right. Keep him close.
Yeah.
So the Iron Warriors are having trouble building this fortress because the stuff that this planet is made out of, well, in 40K we know it as Wraithbone, is this kind of organic polymer that the Eldar grow structures out of. And this planet itself is resisting being reshaped. So while the Iron Warriors are trying to turn it into concrete, it is just falling apart and crumbling, cracks form immediately. They're not really able to, it doesn't conform to any known geological or construction type that the Imperium has ever come across. And so when Kroger gets frustrated, what does he do, Brandon?
Well, he finds some, they call them the New Machina, but we know them as the Dark Mechanicum. He finds some of their tech priests and says, this is taking too long, and he shoots one.
No,
and then one of them gets really...
He doesn't say anything first. He just starts killing them.
Yeah, well, he shoots one. The other one says something in binary. He shoots that one. And then he points at the other one and says, do you speak Gothic? And he's like, yes, I speak Gothic. And he goes, great, and kills him.
Yeah, and then he radios him to find some new tech priests to build his fucking wall.
Yeah, oh, man, that was funny.
So after this point, we get to see another really interesting aspect of Iron Warriors warfare is they have this big armored column of Land Raiders and Rhinos.
I want a model for these Rhinos.
Yeah, these Rhinos.
They are so cool.
The way that these Rhinos operate, but that's like the tip of the iceberg with the whole Iron Warriors pimp my ride. What does Perdurabo show up in, Brandon?
Perdurabo has his converted shadow sword dedicated transport.
He has a super heavy Titan Killer as his daily driver.
It's so amazing. It's called the Tormentor. It is my favorite tank in all of existence. It's glorious. And so they have that. They have the Castellan Rhino, which is a rhino that when it stops, it can actually fold out and they can interlink together to become walls.
So the Iron Warriors basically have a mobile fortress, a column of mobile fortress moving forward. And they drive into this big city that appears to be uninhabited. There are like these weird statues of these Eldar machines or whatever, all throughout the city. And it's decorated with all these like shining gems, and we're not really sure what it is. 40K enthusiasts will know immediately what this stuff is. But in 30K, we've never seen this kind of thing yet. Well, kind of. Anyway, while they're going through, they find a checkpoint and they set up this big fortress of all these interlocked rhinos, these Castellan rhinos. And then the Tormentor drives up onto this big platform in the middle and plants itself as like this static firing platform, which I thought was awesome. And then while the Emperor's Children are advancing through the city, it's also noted that they've got these big cargo 10 haulers with them that we'll recognize from the previous story, from the fractured, the Reflection Cracked, I think, where they're on that that Mechanicum outpost that's harvesting like the psychoactive crystals. This is what these big transports are for. They're hauling these big crystals. Anyway, the Emperor's Children also notice all these gems that the city has. And is it Mirius Ferozian picks one up? And
I don't remember. One of them does, and they start cracking them.
Because they're Eldar Soul Stones. And Slaanesh is just nuts for this kind of stuff, because that's how Slaanesh was born. You know, on the souls of the Eldar. So the Emperor's Children just go ham, destroying as many of these things as they can find. And it's this kind of gruesome scene of them, like, breaking them and try to shove them in their heads. And, you know, it's crazy scene. What did you think of that, Brandon?
Well, yeah, it's super weird and creepy. And I took the Iron Warriors approach of when they look over and see them doing this. And they're like, do you want to know what's going on over there? And they're like, no, not particularly. Yeah, not
So meanwhile, while this is going on, we get a cutaway to Sabak Wayland and Nykona Shuriken again, who are observing this all going on. And there was a little bit of setup back in the fight for the Sisyphean where Nykona Shuriken and Lucius had a duel on the hangar deck, and they fought a little bit, and then they went their separate ways. So now they know each other. In this scene here, during the observation, Shuriken sees him again, sees Lucius out there in the field again, and gets excited because he's like, I'm going to get to fight this, you know, crazy good Emperor's Children guy again, and it's going to be an awesome fight. And that's really interesting setup there, right, Brandon? Don't you think?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. You would think that would be some cool setup for something. Well, the big processional, or this armored column continue to drive. Well, no, the armored column sets down there, and then Perturabo and Fulgrim take, you know, a bunch of guys, and they head into this big palace. It's like the Sepulcher of Aisha's Doom or something like that. Some goofy Eldar shit. Anyway, and they start descending down into the depths of this big sepulcher where they think that this super weapon or this cache of weapons is hidden.
Yeah, and they realize that it's a labyrinth. And so Perturabo realizes, this is why I was meant to be here. And so they work their way through the labyrinth, and they reach a point, and before going on, he's like, hold on a second. Karuchi Vola, which way are we supposed to go? And he points to like one of the paths and says, it's that way. And he says, that's not correct, and snaps his neck. And then he looks at Fulgrim and goes, this guy was never actually here. You've been lying to me this whole time. It's time to be straight. What's going on? and they kind of dance around it, but he sees Fulgrim is sweating light, and which is a weird thing to think about how that would look. But he's like, we're so close, we can't turn back now, and so they press on. And they make it to the central chamber, and then we flash back out to outside where Julius Caseron is just kind of hanging out, and he kind of has like a schizo break, and he's like, I know what I need to do, and just starts chopping up his own guys. And the Iron Warriors see them out there doing this, and they're like, what the fuck are they doing? They're just chopping each other apart, and Forex eventually is like, all right, pull the wall back. I'm taking my command squad out there. We're going to figure out what's going on. Also, at the same time, Tormino has got the Starbish Ash set up, and he's actually been talking to Harker. And Harker's like, all right, we're going to nuke Forex so that you can be a Triarch. He's like, and then we'll eventually kill Kroger. And then they kind of have this thing about, oh, they're Olympian noble blood. I don't think it really sticks. I think they could have just been power hungry and it would have been fine. I don't think they really needed that portion of it, but that's kind of their thought process. And essentially what happens is Julius Caseron kills everyone in his warband. And finally Forex comes out there and is like, what the hell? Why did you do this? And he's like, I did it for Slaanesh. And with that, all of these dead Eldar start to wake up. And so they start running back towards the strong point, but they're getting super bogged down and can barely make it. But they call in a fire mission from the Sorbus Ashk. And Toramino's like, all right, here's my point. I'm going to shell the actual strong point. And he starts shelling the strong point. And these guns are no joke. And Forex is like trying to call back and stop him, but it's not working. And they're just essentially at the point of getting overrun. There's two Titan-sized Eldar. I don't remember what their Titans are called. Like Wraith Lords or something Wraith like Lords that.
The Wraith Lords are like the Dreadnought-sized ones. I don't know. It doesn't matter. They're big Eldar Wraith constructs.
Yeah, and they start tangling with, there's two Legio Mortis Reaver Titans there. And I really wish we would have actually gotten this Titan fight. But we didn't. They just kind of die off screen. Anyway, so we go back inside and these dead Eldar wake up and they all start fighting, and the Emperor's children kind of form up around this stairwell to protect Fulgrim, and Fulgrim goes down this stairwell and Perturabo's like, all right, I'm going to follow him. You guys just hold here. I need to figure out what's going on. And he walks all the way down. And as he's going down these stairs, he's getting warnings from these Eldar of beware she who thirsts. And he's like, look, I don't really care what you dead Eldar did. You're dead and gone. Stop talking to me. I'm doing this now. And essentially ignores them. But he's like, he's feeling weak. He's feeling tired the further down he goes. Until he eventually gets down there. And do you want to talk about the scene here with Fulgrim in the center of the planet?
Yeah, stuff starts to get weird here. It's revealed that this brooch or clasp that Fulgrim gave Perturabo is actually the Morgutter Stone. And there's two of these things. Fulgrim has one as well, and it draws power from one and puts it in the other. So Fulgrim has been siphoning away Perturabo's strength and vitality this entire time and storing it in the other stone. And the Iron Warriors and the Emperor's children eventually break down and start fighting. Well, they're fighting against these Eldar constructs and spirits or whatever, and then eventually kind of starting to fight themselves. And then Perturabo and Fulgrim get drawn into the center of the planet here because Perturabo is too weak to do anything about it. So Fulgrim just drags him along. But it devolves into this scene of Eidolon taking the anatheme that is now back into the story.
Why don't you talk about Kroger real fast?
Okay, so Kroger, each one of the Iron Warriors kind of has this kind of flashback or this break. They're all kind of affected differently. Kroger is affected in a way that sends him through all his previous lives. Like he's a caveman that's fighting other fur-clad humans. He's a Aztec warrior fighting conquistadors. And then eventually it shows him is fighting with a bayonet in the trenches of World War I. And I think we brought this up in our No No Fear episode with Locke, where Elanius Pius has the flashback of fighting at Verdun and spearing a guy that's eating one of his compatriots or one of his comrades. Elanius Pius is the one that speared Kroger, because we get Kroger's opposite or Kroger's perspective of this scene. He was fighting at Verdun, and then one of his comrades got hit with a grenade, and instead of Kroger going to help him, he just like is overwhelmed with bloodlust and starts to cannibalize his, former comrade here. And then Elanius Pius comes up over the trench and guts him with his bayonet. And that's near the end of the scene. The next scene is he wakes up in the a field hospital, and there's a medic leaning over him saying, "Don't worry, we'll fix you up." But then he blacks out after that from a wound on his head that he didn't remember getting. So that's why I thought, Brent, I know I texted you about this. Do you think it's implied that the medic was like a previous incarnation of Fabius? But you didn't seem to think so.
I didn't really pick up that read.
Because I kind of got like evil doctor kind of vibes from that very end of the scene. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. But
it's all kind of speculation.
But it is seen that Elanius's Pius's dog tags are seen when Kroger is stabbed, so we know it was him there.
Yeah, and when he finally wakes up, he realizes that okay, my bloodlust isn't just a. It has a higher purpose now, and essentially it's him giving himself over to Khorne. And I really don't like this because I know Kroger's story ending. And so it's not the greatest, but they went too far here. They have to pull it back.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. When I get into Storm of Iron, I'll definitely look into that.
Yeah. He's in it. He's in Storm of Iron.
I think I knew that, because a lot of the characters here are almost all Graham McNeil's characters from Storm of Iron.
Yeah.
But like you said, this is kind of a soft prequel to Storm of Iron.
Yeah. And Barb and Falk, what he sees this skull that he's been seeing since he looked directly into the Eye of Terror, and he's been seeing this skull everywhere now. And it actually talks to him, and it's like, "You're nameless."
I at first thought it was, when I just saw the Iron Mask, I thought it was Barabbas Dantioch, because we know that he's in the realm of Ultramar working for Gilliman, and he's got this like kind of psychic this weird alien device he's working with that kind of allows him to project himself other places. So at first I thought it was Barabbas Dantioch, but I'm not sure that's the case anymore.
Now, once again, when you know his ending, you know it's the Chaos Gods. They're fighting, and these like slaves are dumping this crystal down into the center of the planet. And the Iron Warriors are like, "What the hell are they doing? Why are like we can't just sit here and defend? We've got to try and break out." But then Fulgrim and Perturabo come shooting up out of this thing after a while. And then Perturabo falls away with an arc of blood because Fulgrim has stabbed him in the chest.
Well, in the meantime, Eidolon, during that cutaway, Eidolon was taking the anatheme and cutting open Fulgrim's flesh and stuffing Eldar soul stones into his skin.
Yeah, that's after they come back up.
Oh, okay. I guess I got confused at that bit. So they went up and then they went down and then went back up?
No, so they go down. They come back up.
Oh, okay.
And then Eidolon starts cutting him open.
Right.
It's after he stabbed Perturabo.
Gotcha.
But he's got the Morgatos stone.
But when, yeah, right. When Perturabo fell away, he grabbed Fulgrim's Morgator Stone and fell away with it.
Yes.
So at the kind of climax of this terrible ceremony that Eidolon is performing on Fulgrim, Fulgrim is begging for one final stone, but they didn't realize that Perturabo took it away with him.
Yeah.
And he kind of falls away and gets separated from the stone. And about this time, the Iron Hands show up because there was like a back way in. They found their way through the labyrinth and they start going ham on the Iron Warriors and the Emperor's Children when they're fighting one another. So they kind of have the advantage here, despite being a pretty small party. That and they're kind of fresh to the fight. They haven't been beating the shit out of each other for the past 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think of the Dreadnought fight we got here?
I thought it was really good. I liked it a lot.
The way that it's written, when Bombastus is the Iron Hands Dreadnought, when he's talking about the height and weight advantage, is Barossus a Contemptor and Bombastus is a Castiferum?
It might be.
That's kind of what I put together. Yeah. But Bombastus is this kind of psychopath dreadnought that the Iron Hands have put together. And so he goes after Barossus like really hard. And he's got Barossus dead to rights. And then fucking Catarus Grendel comes out of nowhere with a melted gun and saves him at the last minute. And just melts Barossus's faceplate off. Or not Barossus, Bombastus's faceplate off. But it was a pretty cool fight up until that point. We got Dreadnought perspectives, which we don't get a whole lot, but I always appreciate. And kind of one thing that kind of tears my heart about this story is that we get character Dreadnoughts, but I don't really think we have good character Dreadnought rules in 30K right now. Like we've got Rylanor and Telemachus, and I think there's a couple other ones, but like I would like some legit rules for, like, if we're running like an Onslaught campaign where you get your character Praetor, you can also get a character Dreadnought after you have him for a couple of games. I think that would be really cool. Or maybe the Phyrex guys are working on that kind of thing. That would be dope. I really like Dreadnoughts. I guess that's what I'm getting at. And I thought that they did a pretty cool job with kind of Dreadnought psychology throughout this story. Now, the Iron Hands and Nykona Shuriken are there as well. And, you know, they're just giving them hell. But in the middle of this fight, it's Barbon Fulk kind of gets that feeling of speak with my voice and, you know, command them to fight. Because he understands that the Emperor's Children and the Iron Warriors need to work together to fight the Iron Hands. And so he shouts with everything he has, and it kind of stops the battle. Fight the Iron Hands! And from that point on, isn't his personality kind of reshaped when he doesn't answer to Fulk anymore? He just says, I am just the Warsmith.
He is the Warsmith.
Crazy. So, you know, at that point, the fight kind of turns in their favor, in the traitor favor now. But throughout all this, Shuriken and Lucius meet up again, and they have their little duel. And how do you think all that goes, Brandon? What was your take on that? I haven't really asked you about it yet. I just kind of told you my feelings.
Oh, it's fine. I don't find Shuriken that compelling. And also, I think Lucius is a douche.
So that's kind of my thing, is that I'm not rooting for either of these guys, so I don't really care who wins. My big beef with it is that in the previous scene with Shuriken, we had the setup of him getting excited to fight Lucius, and at the end of this fight, he kills Lucius and just says, this means nothing to me. You're a rabid dog that needs to be put down. Which, if you know anything about Lucius's 40k lore, you know that if you beat Lucius in a duel, you take pride in that because he's a very powerful warrior, and it means that you're a very powerful warrior now because you beat him. You are then consumed with pride, and you reincarnate as Lucius, or Lucius is reincarnated through your pride in defeating him. And so he's got this kind of eternal cycle. That's why he's called Lucius the Eternal in 40K, of being reborn through his own death at the hands of another mighty warrior. Shuriken, apparently you can just get out of it by saying, this doesn't mean anything to me. And so this is part of the story that kind of chaps my ass the most, is that he misses, the author misses core elements of a character by doing this. And that just really bothered me at the conclusion of this duel.
Yeah, I agree. I don't particularly like it at all, but I'm not. It just doesn't do it for me at all.
It doesn't mesh. So, getting into that, Shuriken. Is it Shuriken that picks up the Morgutter Stone? Is like, well, I don't want anybody to have this, and then he shoots it and breaks it.
Yeah. So Perturabo had. Lucius couldn't, or not Lucius, Eidolon couldn't find the Morgata Stone because Perturabo had it. Perturabo is like, was threatening to throw it into this chasm so that it would be lost to Fulgrim. But in his mind, he's like, this thing sapped a bunch of my power. I don't actually know that destroying it will help me at all. So he's hesitant to do it. But they're kind of talking shit back and forth. And then eventually he does drop it. And then the Iron Hands have this like clockwork eagle, and it streaks down and grabs it, and Lucius shoots it down. He has this fight with Shuriken, gets killed by Shuriken, and then Shuriken shoots it, and that causes Perturabo to get his power back,
mojo,
but Fulgrim is still able to achieve what he needed to achieve, which is he becomes a demon prince.
He is now Fulgrim the Transfigured. He turns into the big winged willy demon that he is now.
Yeah. So he becomes a big snaky snake, and then he just disappears with all of the Emperor's children. And so the Iron Hands are like, okay, we need to get the heck out of here. The power that was holding this planet in place and not allowing it to be consumed by the black hole is undone. And so the Iron Warriors and the Iron Hands both decide, hey, let's just get out of here before we're consumed
by the black hole. I like that scene because they're glaring at each other from like kind of across this chasm. And Perturabo was like, oh, I know we can kill them now, but they kind of earned it. So they just kind of let each other go.
Yeah. He's like, I'm too pissed at Fulgrim right now. So,
and then actually, Iron Father Thermatica shows up in the, Storm Raven, Storm Eagle. It shows up in the Storm Eagle to pick them up. He flies down into this big pit and picks them up. And I think they salvage Bombastus's dreadnought sarcophagus. So maybe that's foreshadowing. I don't know.
Oh, one of my favorite things we didn't talk about is the deaf Morlock. So there's this Morlock who it got half deafened by like a grenade blast or something on Istvan V. And then during the attack on the Sisyphium, he encountered some noise marines, and that fully deafened him. And then Marius Verosian loses his weapon and then starts screaming this sonic scream at him. And he just goes, you're going to have to speak up, and then shreds him with a Volkite charger.
I loved that. That was so cool.
Oh, that's great. But yeah, so they both withdraw from the planet. And Perturabo is like, fuck Fulgrim. He's an asshole. Also, I'm not feeling too hot on Horus right now either. And they're like, well, what do you want to do? We're about to get consumed by this black hole. And he's like, we can't get away from it, so we're just going to fly into it. And that's where the book ends.
Yeah, he's basically like, I never look back. Forward we go.
Well, that's not where the book ends. The book ends with Lucius waking up in Fabius's apothecarium for some reason.
Yeah, he just wakes up. You know, the mortal wounds dealt to him by Shuriken, they were temporary.
Yeah.
And then Fabius is actually fighting Chrysander and the other Imperial Fist monster. And Fabius is barely holding his own. And he's yelling at Lucius the whole time to save the gene samples, which Lucius is just like, well, maybe having a favor from Fabius isn't so bad. And so he saves these gene samples. And at the very end, we see the only surviving sample just has a torn tag that says Han Su'an.
Which is very big foreshadowing for Storm of Iron.
Yeah.
And anyway, that is Angel Exterminatus. We covered this on a high level, and that is legitimately because I want you all to read this book.
This is a great book. And even with any of the bugaboos I have with it, it's still an amazing book. You know, like I said, Graham McNeil's given us like two or three amazing bangers. False Gods, Mechanicum, and Angel Exterminatus. Three amazing books.
Yeah. So did he write A Thousand Suns?
Yeah, he did.
That's okay. So the first two thirds of that book is not great, but the last third.
Yeah, the last third of that book is great.
Yeah.
He does not. I'm actually glad there were no like civilian perspectives in this book, because he is shit at writing human beings.
Like, it's he's so weird though, because he's so good with Perdurabo.
So good with like superhuman space marines.
Fulgrim is also written very well.
I agree. Oh yeah, he did Fulgrim too. So he's done like, four really good books.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for all my criticisms of him, I will still admit he is one of the better writers of this series. Mm-hmm. So on a scale of 1 to 10, where does it land for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know what I'm going to say. This is a 10 for me.
I'm going to say like an 8.5.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also biased. This is my favorite Legion. I think this is really the only full-length novel that they ever feature in this series, which makes me sad.
Oh, dude, it's a heartbreaker, because there is so much good shit. So much cool stuff they could do with this. And I wish all the Legions got a setup book of this level, but a lot of them just don't. Salamanders don't have a good book. Raven Guard are kind of hit and miss. They're 50-50 with a lot of their material. And their setup book just doesn't really take them anywhere. I think we've talked about that already.
Do Night Lords even get a full-length book?
I don't think they get a single full-length book at all. It sucks.
But it is one of those things. I know we've talked about it before, but it's nice to watch an author write about the Legion that they're passionate about.
Yeah.
And so Graham McNeil's writings on the Iron Warriors is what made me love this Legion. And they are my favorite Legion, and it's not particularly close.
Yeah, and it's understandable to see why. This book does a really good job handling them. So I appreciate that too.
Yeah. So yeah, I can't recommend this one enough. Storm of Iron as well. I know we've talked about that a lot. It ties back into this one. So it is really good. And it's actually one of those where if you read Storm of Iron first and then you read this, the characters are so well done in Storm of Iron that you're not upset about like, oh, you're just kind of mooching the characters from the book you already wrote. No, it's actually like, I want more time with these characters. They're excellent. Anyway, I think that kind of wraps it up here, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've kind of gotten I've got all my thoughts out. I'm in no position to start collecting another army right now. I'm still neck deep in Night Lords, but if I had to pick another Traitor Legion, it would be easy to do these guys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm starting them, so.
I see that.
Yeah.
Man, you're going ham with like three different armies right now, because you're still neck deep in Emperor's Children, and now you want to do some automatons for your Dark Angels, and you still got to finish up them Iron Warriors.
I've just been feeling hot on Heresy right now, man.
I get it. It's an easy bug to catch. I'm not even busting your chops about it. It's so easy to get sucked into a lot of different projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, well, let us know what you guys think of Angel Exterminatus. Again, like I said, this is one of my favorite books in this series.
Definitely a good one. So why don't you guys go ahead and check us out on social media. We are LegionCast, a Horus Heresy podcast on Twitter. Shoot us an email at legioncast18@gmail.com. And don't forget to comment and rate this podcast and share it out to your hobby buddies. We'd love to have you. Until next time.
Yep. Thanks for stopping by, everybody. And remember, from honor cometh iron. this is the unbreakable litany. May it ever be so.